Lawrence will be serving as your online moderator for today's broadcast. Our seminar today will look at the use of passive samplers to monitor organic contaminants at Superfund sediment sites and has been sponsored by the EPA's Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation. In just a moment, we'll be joined by our first speaker, Dr. Robert Burgess, followed by a second presenter, Dr. Mark Greenberg. I'll be providing introductions for both of those speakers in just a few moments, but just a brief reminder, today's session, again, is going to explore passive samplers, which are useful new tools for assessing contaminant exposures and evaluating the potential for adverse environmental effects at Superfund sites. Since the 1990s, passive samplers have been used for monitoring contaminant concentrations in the water column, soil and sediment waters, as well as air at sites around the world. However, their use in sediments to date has been primarily for research. Today's webinar will introduce the concepts behind passive sampling, the types of passive samplers currently available to monitor dissolved organic contaminants, and the general methods for deployment and analysis. It will also discuss the potential uses of passive samplers in the different phases of the Superfund process and the advantages as well as disadvantages of their use. This webinar is based on and complementary to the recently released sediment assessment and monitoring sheet on the use of passive samplers at Superfund sites, which the U.S. EPA published back in December of 2012. We do have a link to that that's available on the seminar resources or seminar links page that you're going to find if you've joined us in the Adobe Connect room on the right side. Before we kick off the technical portion, though, for today's broadcast, I'm going to cover a couple of instructions and reminder items. Again, if this is your first CLUIN seminar, I'll refer you back to a registration email that would have had a complete set of instructions on how to join us for today's broadcast. That email would have pointed you to something called the seminar homepage, which had a complete description of today's event, links to download the slides as well as review the other websites and specifically find the document that today's session is based on, links to provide feedback, contact information, and bios for both of our presenters, but most importantly, a big button at the top that says Go to Seminar. If you click that button, you'll be asked to identify yourself as you registered, and you'll be able to join us in the online interactive Adobe Connect room. The entire broadcast today will be offered live through Adobe Connect, so you'll be able to both watch as well as listen to our presenters as they deliver the talk through Adobe Connect. So you can basically sit back and let them click through the slides, just like I'm doing right now. If you have problems with Adobe Connect, though, or you prefer, you can also download the slides in advance, although we do recommend that you work with us to try to troubleshoot any problems you might have because it is a much more interactive and robust experience online through Adobe Connect. By default, audio is available online through the Adobe Connect room for all participants. You can use your own volume or speaker controls to adjust it as needed. If you're having problems and it's too soft, again, first check your local speaker settings. You might need to increase your speaker output. If that doesn't work for you, we do have telephone lines. We'll be happy to provide the free call-in information for anyone who needs it. Simply type a message in the Q&A window in the lower right corner, and I'll get you that call-in information as soon as possible. If you do join us on the telephone lines, we have globally muted the phones, and we would ask that everybody remain muted to help cut down on other audio disruptions. We will take breaks for Q&A, and at that point, we'll remind you how you can submit questions. We are going to ask that you use the Q&A window for the primary method to ask questions, comments, and support, or submit technical problems if you have any of them. Today's session is being recorded and will be available via email roughly 1 to 2 weeks after the live broadcast. You will automatically be notified once that archive is available for free replay and download, and you're certainly welcome to forward that to anyone that you think will be find it a useful expenditure of their time. If you want, you can browse the nearly 510, I believe, archive seminars that we have up on the CLUIN website. We encourage you to share those with colleagues that will find it useful. Just a brief reminder for today's broadcast. Again, you're going to see a large window that's going to occupy the majority of your screen where the slides will be presented. If you have any problems viewing those slides, there's a full screen button that appears in the upper right corner of that window. You can click the full screen button to make the slides bigger. If you want to turn that view off, simply press the full screen button again. It'll shrink the slides back down. To the right of that window, you'll see a series of boxes stacked on top of each other, starting with the CLUIN logo in the upper right corner. Just below that, there's a related website or links box that actually has a collection of active hyperlinks. You can click on any one of those links, press the Browse to button, and those websites will open up locally on your computer. And then most importantly, that Q&A window in the lower right corner. You can privately submit your comments, questions, and technical problems at any time by typing them in here and then pressing the little cartoon bubble or hitting the Enter key on your keyboard. I encourage you to test that functionality out. If you're not comfortable with it, go ahead and type up a test message. Just give me a quick status indicator. Let me know how the audios and visuals sound. A big thanks to those of you who have already given us live feedback. We always appreciate that. Again, there will be designated breaks for Q&A. but you can type up your questions at any point. We encourage you to type them up early, as soon as they occur to you, so we can build up a big queue and get through as many questions as we can in the time that we have allotted. I think that's the end of the reminders that I have for today's live broadcast. I'm going to go ahead and turn things over to our first presenter, Dr. Robert Burgess. Dr. Robert Burgess is a research physical scientist at U.S. EPA's Office of Research and Development in their Atlantic Ecology Division, where he's been with the U.S. EPA for about 20 years. His current research focuses on better understanding the partitioning and bioavailability of organic and metal contaminants. He's participated in a number of review committees on both the national and international level, as well as on several scientific workshops, in addition to contributing to over almost 100 peer-reviewed papers and books and chapters, most of which were related to sediment contamination. Dr. Burgess received a master's degree in biological oceanography and a PhD in chemical oceanography from the University of Rhode Island as a graduate school of oceanography. So with that, let me go ahead and turn things over to Dr. Burgess.
Thank you, Jean, and good afternoon to everybody. Having a little technical difficulty changing slides. Okay, so we're on slide number 2 at this point. And as Jean just said with her introduction, the first part of this presentation is going to focus on the SAMS document, the SAMS number 3 that came out in December of 2012. It provides a nice overview of using passive samplers at contaminated sites. And the intended target audience were the remedial project office, or project managers, RPMs at Superfund sites. So taking essentially the table of contents from that document, what we'll talk about at the first half of the seminar this afternoon is the use of passive samplers and what they tell us, the types of passive samplers and a little bit on how they work, selecting, preparing, deploying, recovering, and storing passive samplers, analyzing passive sampler data, and I'll provide a very brief case study showing how some of that data could be used, and then a couple of the scientific challenges that still exist in using passive samplers. And then there's a table that's taken right out of the SAMS document that has a list of EPA staff, EPA folks who are working with passive samplers. And then Mark will go into some detail on the actual application of passive samplers at Superfund sites, and then we'll have a summary. I want to start with this cartoon showing the relationship between contaminated sediments and the aquatic life in that system. So we have the atmosphere, we have our water, we have our contaminated sediments, of course, and we have in populating the system some wildlife, some fish, some benthos. Now, if we can look at what's going on with the contaminants in the sediments, we could somehow blow up what's going on in the sediments, we'd see that most of the contaminants are associated with the sediment particles, and a few of them, a very small amount, are actually associated with the interstitial waters. And it's those contaminants that are in the interstitial waters that are the dissolved and bioavailable contaminants. And those are the ones we're most concerned with at contaminated sites, because they're the ones who represent the exposure and any potential risk at a contaminated site. The contaminants on the sediments are bioavailable, but aren't the best surrogate for what's truly bioavailable in the system. Now, we know that those dissolved and bioavailable contaminants can diffuse through the sediments. They can also be advected into the water column during storm events or due to ship traffic. And as a result, these dissolved contaminants, dissolved PCBs in this case, will make their way up into the benthos, into the fish, into the mussels. And again, what we're trying to get at are the dissolved and bioavailable concentrations of these contaminants, not how much contaminant is associated with the sediments. So how can we make these measurements of dissolved and bioavailable contaminants in the water column and in the interstitial waters? Well, we do have conventional methods that we've been using for years and years and years, for literally for decades, but they do have some problems associated with them. In the water column, it is technically and logistically difficult to collect very large volumes of water and then extract it. And there are all sorts of artifacts associated with collecting large volumes of water, including losses to filters and surfaces like the glassware and the labware, and also contamination by very small colloids and very small particles. So both of those factors, losses to surfaces and filters, and then the presence of small particles and colloids, is going to result in artifacts in the data. We also, with the water column especially, run into detection limit issues. It's just very difficult to measure very low concentrations of contaminants in large volumes of water. Now, in the interstitial waters, the two techniques that we most commonly use for generating interstitial waters, centrifugation or squeezing the sediment to get the interstitial water out, result in relatively limited volumes of water. And then at the same time, we run into all the artifacts that we have in the water column, losses of contaminants to filters, losses to surfaces, as well as the presence of colloids and small particles contaminating the samples. In general, collecting large volumes of interstitial water is logistically challenging, a little bit dodgy scientifically, and generally expensive. So the question we raise is there another way to measure the dissolved and bioavailable concentrations of contaminants? And this is where the passive samplers come into play, of course. They were developed in the 1980s or thereabouts in the analytical chemistry and food sciences, as well as in pharmaceutical sciences. They've been used in environmental sciences probably since the 1990s in the water column, soils, some groundwater studies, as well as in sediments. And as Gene said at the beginning, with sediments, mostly in a research mode. Very, very simply, and I'll show you some more illustrations of the following point in a moment, but very simply, passive samplers consist of an organic phase, a polymer, or some sort of organic film that the contaminants dissolve into from the dissolve phase. The most common passive samplers in North America currently are polyethylene, PE, polyoxymethylene, POM, and solid phase microextraction. You've probably also heard of SPMDs, semipermeable membrane devices, but they're not used as often with sediments, and so we're not going to focus on them for this discussion. In terms of the types of contaminants that these passive samplers will collect, we're talking about the hydrophobic or non-ionic organic contaminants. So these are the chemicals that have very low solubilities in water, but they're very highly lipophilic, that is, they bioaccumulate, and they'll have log KOWs from about 3 up to 8 or 9, so the medium to the large KOW chemicals. And they generally are the contaminants of concern at Superfund sites, the PCBs, the PHs, the DDTs, and other chlorinated pesticides, as well as dioxins and furans. Now, there are passive samplers being developed for metals, but they're not as well developed as the organic contaminant passive samplers, so we won't talk about them today either. So why should we use passive samplers? Analytically, passive samplers accumulate contaminants over time during their deployment, and I'll show you a little bit of that in a second. And what that does is it makes the detection limit issues that we had less of a problem, because as they accumulate the contaminants, you don't have very, very low concentrations in your sampler. You actually have elevated concentrations that analytically are relatively easy to measure. Representativeness of data, because they're deployed in the field for long periods of time, we get a time-averaged or time-integrated measurement of the contaminants concentration, not just a snapshot of the contaminants concentration, which is what we get with our conventional techniques. And then there's expense, of course, that always comes into play. This is a table that shows the cost of analyzing different types of water samples, including passive sampler water samples. So on the left-hand side, we have water that's analyzed conventionally. And if you go over to the right-hand side of the table, the cost is about $500. But if you use a passive sampler, polyethylene, POM, or SPME, the cost is about $100 to $200 cheaper. And that's the way it stands right now. So there is a cost savings using passive samplers, even at this point. So more on expense, again, there's about $100 to $200 less cost associated with using passive samplers for water column concentrations compared to conventional methods. And as commercial laboratories begin to establish more experience with extracting and analyzing passive samplers, I would imagine the prices will start to come down even further. In reality, the research laboratories that are using passive samplers find them easier to work with than doing a soil or sediment or a tissue extraction. The passive samplers are just cleaner materials to work with. The other thing is passive samplers aren't that expensive. They're relatively cheap pieces of plastic, and if they're lost or damaged during a deployment, it really isn't that expensive for your monitoring. It's not that great a loss. Okay, what do passive samplers tell us? The first thing is the concentration of the contaminant in the passive sampler itself. And this can be related or correlated to the bioaccumulation of contaminants by aquatic organisms. And this is an area of research that is quite active right now, seeing how well passive samplers serve this purpose as surrogates for bioaccumulating organisms. And this could come in handy if you wanted to do some sort of monitoring in a site that had low dissolved oxygen or toxicity or low or high temperatures that would make it difficult to deploy actual live organisms. The second thing that passive samplers tell us, and this is what I started talking about earlier, is they give us the dissolved concentration of the contaminants of concern in the water around them, in the interstitial water, in the water column. And so you end up with this dissolved phase concentration that we know is the bioavailable concentration, and you can compare this to water quality criteria, to other water quality standards or toxicity testing data. I just want to show you more on what passive samplers tell you. I have a plot here, the starting of a plot here, dissolved concentration in nanograms per liter. And so this is, say, a concentration of a PCB congener over our deployment period, over our over time on the x-axis. Now, what I'm showing you is the actual concentration of this PCB over time. And in reality, we probably really can't measure this. We don't have the technology to do this sort of instantaneous measurement at any given moment in time. But say we could, the trace of the contaminant's concentration might look like this. And we might be able to explain some of the peaks as due to storm vents causing resuspension that result in the release of contaminants into the water column, flooding that results in dilution of the dissolved phase concentration, or maybe ship traffic that results in a smaller resuspension event. Now, with the passive sampler, what it's going to do is it's going to be collecting, accumulating the contaminants in the polymer, just as I mentioned earlier. Now, because of the way the passive sampler accumulates contaminants, it's not going to follow the actual concentration exactly, but it's going to adjust over time the concentration in the passive sampler, which then reflects the dissolved phase concentration. So by the time we get to the end of our 30-day deployment, we get this time-integrated or time-average measurement. And again, this is probably a better measurement of what a given organism in the system is experiencing than just taking a snapshot at any given point, the way we did with conventional methods, or taking a snapshot at a really low point or a high point that gives us a false sense of what the concentration is in the system and what organisms are exposed to. So we get back to our conceptual cartoon, and again, we're trying to get at the dissolved and bioavailable concentration of these contaminants for using passive samplers. Now I'll go into a little bit more of the nitty-gritty of passive samplers for those of you who haven't seen them before. So again, we're talking about polyethylene on the left-hand side of the screen, the very common plastic. We actually use the drop cloth that you can buy, the plastic drop cloth that you can buy at hardware stores to do for painting purposes. You put it down on the floor. That is polyethylene, and that plastic can be used as a passive sampler. Thickness, you want it as thin as possible, 25 to 50 microns is common. On the right-hand side, we have polyoxymethylene, POM, which is a little bit more rigid, more robust type of passive sampler material or polymer. It's similar to the old acetates we used to use for overhead projection in the old days. And 75 micron is a thickness that you can get commercially. SPEMI is a little bit more challenging to describe. It is actually fiber optic cable, and this is on the left-hand side. The interior of the SPEMI is actually the glass core, and that's not really of interest to us. That's where the fiber optics are going on. But the exterior of the SPEMI is covered with an insulating polymer called polydimethyl siloxane, PDMS, and this actually absorbs organic contaminants fairly well, and so consequently, it's been used as a passive sampling material. I said I wasn't going to talk about SPMDs anymore, but I did want to just give you a quick photograph. So SPMDs can be half a meter to a meter long, about 2.5 centimeters long, wide. You know, it varies on, depending on the application. And just to give you an idea of what these look like, passive samplers are generally made also out of polyethylene, like I showed you on the slide before, but instead of being a sheet, which is what a polyethylene passive sampler consists of, it's actually tubing. And so the interior of the SPMD contains triolein, which is a synthetic type of lipid, and the idea is the contaminant partitions from the water into the polyethylene and then into the triolein. Unfortunately, this slide got a little messed up, but what I want to show you here is just the structures of these polymers. They're fairly simple molecules. These are just single chains being shown here. Polyethylene is made up of carbon and hydrogen. It's the simplest. Polyoxymethylene is made up of carbon and hydrogen, but it also has some oxygens in there. And then the PDMS that's used with the SPEMI is made up of carbons, hydrogens, oxygens, and some silicon. Now, in reality, these polymers would not be single chains like we see here. During a deployment, there would be, in the plastic we're using, in the polymer we're using, there would be sheet upon sheet of these on top of one another, making the thickness of our final passive sampler polymer. And the reason these work so well with organic contaminants is because the organic contaminants we're trying to collect are just like the polymer material, and it gets us back to that adage that you heard back in organic chemistry that like dissolves like. The contaminants, like in this case a dioxin, actually dissolves into the polymer, and that's how the passive sampler works. The contaminants actually partition into the plastic. Okay, so now a little illustrative theory on how the passive samplers actually operate. So we'll take some water, and this is contaminated water, so it has some PCB molecules in it. We'll add a passive sampler, could be PE or POM, and the initial concentration of the PCBs in the passive sampler are very low, and I'll talk about that in just a moment. You want to make sure that when we start a deployment, there's as little contamination of the passive sampler as possible. And then over time, as the polymer is sitting in the water, the PCBs are going to try and reach equilibrium between themselves and between the environment and the polymer. And so that's what's illustrated here. And we can illustrate this further going to a plot where we have concentration of the PCB nanograms per gram passive sampler on the y-axis. On the x-axis, we have deployment time in days. And over time, the passive sampler accumulates the PCBs. And this gets back to the point I mentioned about detection limits. By the end of your deployment, you're going to have accumulated fairly, potentially, elevated concentrations of a given contaminant, which then can be extracted out and analyzed. And so, as I said, detection limits become less of an issue. We can convert this data into a uptake curve, and at some point, the contaminant reaches equilibrium between the passive sampler and the environment, the aqueous phase it was in. Now the next step is to take this equilibrium concentration of the contaminant in the passive sampler and convert it over to that dissolved and bioavailable concentration that we're really, really interested in. So here's the fairly simple equation we use to do that. We have the dissolved concentration over here in nanograms per mil, for example. On top of the equation, we have the concentration actually measured in the sampler. So that's what the laboratory that analyzes the sampler will provide, is the concentration, the C sampler concentration. And then finally, we divide through by a passive sampler dissolved partition coefficient to calculate our dissolved and bioavailable concentration of the contaminant. And again, one thing I want to emphasize is that these are equilibrium samplers, and so it's critical that we get to equilibrium, where the contaminant is at a point that it's at equilibrium between the passive sampler, how much is accumulated in the passive sampler, and the aqueous environment around it, or the interstitial water environment around it. Before we get into more nitty-gritty on preparation and deployment and recovery and things like that, I just want to mention a couple of key points. Today's presentation, at least my part, is more generic overview of passive sampling, from the SAMS document. But I did want to point out, and I think Mark will probably talk about this as well, last fall, 2012, CTAC held a Pelston workshop on passive sampling, and the result of that is going to be a series of scientific papers coming out in 2014 that will go into some detail on passive sampling. So there'll be technical papers on passive sampling. And they'll provide some practical guidance for field deployments, QA, QC, things like that. Also, the CERDUP ESTCP organization, which is a collaboration between Department of Energy, Department of Defense, and the agency, is currently funding a research project to develop specific guidance for using passive samplers at contaminated sites. The plan is to have that completed in late 2014, early 2015. Currently, the plan is to have it as a, publish it as a EPA document, and the contents would include actual SOPs for field deployment, recovery, chemical analysis, QA, QC considerations. So it again, would be a very useful document, giving a lot of specifics on how to use passive samplers. And one target audience for that document, for the CERDUP ESTCP document, is to be used by contractors and contract laboratories. Okay, getting into some more on the preparation. Really the key, and I mentioned this before, is that the passive samplers be as clean as possible before they're deployed so that you don't have any contamination issues. To do this, samplers are usually soaked in organic solvent before deployment, then they're soaked in DI water to remove the organic solvent, and then wrapped in some sort of foil, aluminum foil, put in a plastic bag, and then stored at negative 4 degrees C until deployment time. And then they're taken into the field if you're doing a field deployment, and on ice so that they're kept as cold as possible. Okay, actually deploying the passive samplers, I'll just go through some photographs just to give you a sense of what these things look like in the field. We have PE here, this, sort of on the left-hand side of the slide. We also have some POM, and this is being deployed in a minnow trap. So this way you retain the samplers inside this container, and they're less likely to fall off or get lost. We also have some SPEMI fibers that are in these copper mesh envelopes. They're also attached during these deployments. Another way of deploying PE or POM is on the right-hand side of the slide, and that's by using a stainless steel ring that you've threaded the POM or PE through. And I should say those were primarily water column deployments. Here are some cartoons showing what these would look like in a simplistic system. So we have the PE or POM attached to the stainless steel rings. We have the fish traps or minnow traps with the PE or POM. And also we can deploy SPEMI in these tubes. I'll show you those in just a moment. Or in sediments. They can also be deployed in tubes, and I'll show you that right now. So for sediment deployments, here's some examples. Here's SPEMI. For this particular type of SPEMI deployment, the SPEMI are attached to these syringes that serve to protect them as well as serve as a way to deploy them. Get my arrow over here. This tube here, the copper tube right here, is for water column deployments, whereas the copper tube down here with the stainless steel mesh is for sediment deployments. But again, in both cases, the SPEMI fibers would be inside of these copper tubes or these copper tubes with stainless steel. Here's a similar type of system out of Denmark that was just published upon, and this also has SPEMI inside this copper protective coating. Here's another system. This is one that Danny Rival uses at the University of Texas, where you have a stainless steel rod that has a opening in the center, a hollowed out portion of the center, and SPEMI fibers can be inserted in there and deployed vertically in the sediment. The circles that just showed up are just to show you what where the SPEMI fibers are. Another type of sediment deployment system is to take the polymers, the PE and the POM, which are more sheet-like, and fasten them between aluminum or stainless steel frames, and these can be inserted vertically into the sediment also. And again, here's a cartoon illustrating what these would look like. And again, you know, these cartoons are very, very simplistic. In an actual deployment, of course, they would be more, a bit more sophisticated. With the sediment deployments, of course, diver assistance, or even in the water column deployments, diver assistance can be a very useful approach to take. This is Phil Geschwind from MIT handing one of these vertical PE samplers to a diver at a Superfund site in San Francisco Bay. And I should point out that both Osrati's dive team and Region 10's dive team have a great deal of experience with deploying and recovering passive samplers. And so they could serve as resources for any of you out there who are interested in having passive samplers deployed. Finally, on the deployment part, this is a system that we had built for some work at the Palos Verdes Superfund site off of LA. And we have, leave over here, POM in the water column. Here's another photograph on the right-hand side, just to get another angle at what this this device looked like. This is what the system looks like when it was deployed. This was actually one of the test units, but you can get an idea of what the system looks like. So we have samplers in the water column above the sediment surface. We also have samplers below the sediment surface, and this allows us to make a measurement of the flux of contaminants from the sediment into the water, which is potentially useful to know. Okay, after the deployment, after the 28-day to 30-day deployment, or longer, the passive samplers are removed from their deployment gear, wiped to remove any material that's accumulated on the surface of the passive sampler. Also, you could rinse with DI water very quickly. And then wrapped in foil again, or placed into clean glass jars if the samplers are smaller samplers, and returned to the laboratory on ice again, and then stored in the dark at negative 4 degrees C until extraction and chemical analysis can be performed. Selecting passive samplers, and this is a tricky one because each practitioner has their favorite and has had good and bad experiences with each of them. So there's a table here. It's probably not comprehensive, but I'll point out a couple things. With PE and POM, the couple of advantages of them is that they're inexpensive, robust and rugged. You can pick them up and move them around without being concerned about ruining them. Oh, drats, my computer just died, but I do have hard copies. So hold on a second. I'll tell you what slide I'm on. Okay, so we're still on slide 29, which is the selecting passive samplers. If we go to SPEME, and Gene, if you can push the button, I think a circle will show up. Again, SPEME is a fairly inexpensive polymer, and it's known for rapidly equilibrating, which is kind of a very nice thing to have. Disadvantages with PE and with POM gets back to that equilibration issue. They just don't equilibrate as quickly as the SPEMEs do. And finally, with the SPEME, the disadvantage, and I think you've seen this from the slides I was showing, the fibers tend to be very fragile, or arguably can be fragile. And so whenever you deploy them, you need to have some sort of protective coating on them, either a copper tube or stainless steel tube or something to keep them from being broken during the deployment period. If we go on to the next slide, which is slide 30, it's analyzing passive sampler data. And what I wanted to highlight here, because I've already gone through the calculation in an earlier slide, but what I wanted to show here is that when you receive the data back from the laboratory, the commercial laboratory that analyzes the passive samplers for you, preferably the data will be in units of micrograms of the contaminant per gram passive sampler. In some cases, it might be in units of micrograms per mil sampler. And in that case, it's just a matter of dividing through by the density of the polymer to get into units of micrograms per gram. And so that's no big deal. Once you have the data, the raw data, that is your C sampler concentration that we've talked about. You just stick it into the equation that we talked about earlier. That becomes the numerator. And that's divided by the sampler dissolved phase partition coefficient. So that's in the numerator, and on the slide it's shown as K sampler dash D. And by doing that division, you get your dissolved and bioavailable concentration. Partition coefficients, there are several of them available in the literature. The SAMS document that we're talking about today has a list of partition coefficients that you can use. The CTAC publications that come out next year will have a list of recommended partition coefficients. And the CERDUP ESTCP document that comes out in a year or so will also have a list of partition coefficients. And there's a lot of partition coefficients in the literature as well. So there's no shortage of partition coefficients. It's really just figuring out which ones to select to use. If we go to the next slide, slide 31, and that's I just want to go through a brief case study. It sounds like Mark is going to go into some detail on some of these applications of passive samplers at Superfund sites, but let me just give you a quick overview of one case. So this is the Palos Verdes Shelf Superfund site. We had water column and sediment deployments. This is the site that's off the coast of California. Carmen was the RPM, and Judy is now the RPM, and both have been very supportive of our doing some research at this particular site. It's a deep water marine site, 60 meters deep. Contaminants of concern are DDTs and PCDs. We had 12 water column stations, and at those 12 stations, we had passive samplers deployed 5 meters from the surface, 5 meters from the bottom, and then also at the 30-meter depth mark in the water column. We also had 5 sediment stations. The objectives of the work there, and it was somewhat researchy, but had applications directly back to the site. The first was to determine water column concentrations of contaminants during, before, during, and after the remediation activity at the site. We're still at the before part of the remediation at that site. The second was to determine the magnitude of flux of contaminants from the sediments up into the water columns, The water column deployment stations that we used in 2010, and again, there were 12 of those. The next slide, slide 33, is the DDE dissolved concentration at each of the stations at 5 meters above the bottom. Concentrations ranged from about 600 to about 2,500 picograms per liter. So that's parts per quadrillion, very, very low concentrations. But because you're using passive samplers and they accumulate the contaminants, detection limits were not too much of a problem analytically. If there's a column that's red, that means both the human health and the aquatic life criteria were exceeded based on those dissolved phase concentrations that were determined at each station. If it's just a yellow column, that just means the human health criteria was exceeded. The next slide, slide 34, is the total PCB concentration. I should note on the previous slide, slide 33, the DDE was the most abundant contaminant. So going on to slide 34, total PCB dissolved concentrations. And again, here, if there's a yellow column, that meant the concentration exceeded the human health criteria. And concentrations here range from about 75 to about 300 picograms per liter. The next slide, slide 35, this is the sediment deployment stations, and this is very preliminary data, but I just wanted to show it to you very quickly. If we focus in on station 6C, we should have a plot that comes up showing on the y-axis the depth above the water column up to about 25 centimeters and the depth into the sediments down to about 25 centimeters. And this was data that we derived using that platform I showed you that had passive samplers deployed up in the water column and also in the sediments. So the sediment concentrations shown here, the trace that you see, are basically the interstitial water concentrations. The concentration up in the water column are the water column concentrations. And based on these data, we were able to come up with an estimate of the flux of the DDE going from the sediments up into the water column. And in this case, it was 260 nanograms of DDE per centimeter squared per year. So again, that was just a short case study showing different applications of the passive samplers. On the next slide, which is slide 36, I just want to go into a couple of the scientific challenges that those of us in ORD and also in the scientific community are focusing on with passive samplers. And as I mentioned earlier, these are equilibrium samplers. So knowing when they've achieved equilibrium is key. Generally, we don't have what we call time series data, where we've gone out and deployed multiple passive samplers and collect and recover them over time and come up with this nice uptake curve. Usually we just do one deployment and one recovery, and it's because of cost reasons. It's just too expensive to do time series deployments every single time. And determining when equilibrium has been achieved between the passive sampler and the contaminants is a challenge in all monitoring, including biomonitoring with mussels, for example. So one solution that's being looked at is the use of performance reference compounds, also known as PRCs. And these are compounds that are loaded into the passive sampler before deployment. And once the deployment starts, the PRCs are released into the water, while at the same time the target contaminants are being accumulated by the passive sampler. So far, the PRC technique has been used with PE and POM most often. Hasn't been used with SPME too much because, as I mentioned earlier, SPME generally equilibrate very quickly. But there is some research looking at adding PRCs to SPME as well. So if we go to the next slide, so this is slide 37, I think with the first click, we'll see an image of the passive sampler. And now it shows the passive sampler, it's been loaded with polybrominated diphenyl ethers, PBDEs. We now add PCBs to the water around the passive sampler, and I think with a couple clicks, the animation will start. And what we should see is, as time goes by, the PBDEs, which are the PRCs, will leave the passive sampler and go into the water column. They're trying to establish equilibrium between themselves in the polymer and the water around them. At the same time, the PCBs in the water are going to be partitioning into the passive sampler, again trying to establish equilibrium, just like we saw in the earlier slides. And of course, this isn't quite as orderly as it's shown in this animation. If we go to the next slide, 38, and click on that, we'll see that we have the PCBs accumulating in the passive sampler as time goes by, and at the same time, the PRCs, the PBDEs in this example, decrease with time. And if we click that again, just like in our earlier slide, we get an uptake curve for the PCB, and now we also have a release curve for the PRCs, in this case the PBDEs. And relatively simple mathematics can be done to come up with the relationship between the uptake versus the uptake of the PCBs versus the loss of the PRCs. And that math, and I won't show it to you, but if it were done, it would come up with a new C sampler concentration. We've talked about C sampler already, but now it's adjusted for equilibrium conditions. So that's as far as I'll go with the use of PRCs, but it's an area that there's a lot of research going on to determine the best way, the optimum way of using PRCs for doing deployments with passive samplers. The final scientific challenge is the whole idea, and this is on slide 40, and this is the whole idea of how good a surrogate are passive samplers for actual aquatic organisms. So the uptake by the passive sampler, how appropriate is that as a surrogate for bioaccumulation by some sort of aquatic or benthic organism? And I think in the illustration I show on slide 40, you'll see essentially is the passive sampler equal to a bunch of mussels? And this is key to understand how good the passive samplers do serve as surrogates for aquatic organisms, because that'll drive how we interpret that type of data, you know, using passive sampler data as a surrogate for bioaccumulation data by benthic organisms and passive samplers. So that data set is being generated as we speak. And what might ultimately come out of that is that we could come up with a series of linear equations for given organisms where we could predict what concentration would bioaccumulate in them just based on a passive sampler that was deployed in the system. And again, this might be for cases where you have a system that's so polluted that you can't deploy fish, you can't deploy mussels because it's just too toxic or the conditions are too harsh for using organisms, maybe during a hot summer or a cold winter. If you click that slide again, a plot should come up just showing concentrations of PCB congeners in a polychaete versus concentrations in a passive sampler. And this is a study we did back in 2009. And the red line you see is the one-to-one line. And you can see our data falls in that line pretty well. So I think there is a great deal of promise with the idea of using passive samplers as surrogates for organisms in some applications. We go to the next slide, slide 41. This shows a list of EPA folks who are working with passive samplers. There are people in ORD on the list. There are people in the regions. There are RPMs. So there's a good group of people out there already who have used passive samplers and could serve as a resource for anyone who wants to ask some questions about using passive samplers at their sites. Gene, I guess I'll finish up with a brief summary. Does that sound right?
That does indeed.
Okay. All right, so we're now on slide 42. And just very rapidly, and this is the summary slide. Passive sampling is a scientifically sound and cost-effective approach for monitoring contaminant concentrations. And this is both in the water column and the interstitial waters. The type of information passive samplers provide are the dissolved and bioavailable concentration that I've tried to emphasize throughout the presentation, and also the concentration that accumulates in the passive sampler itself that might be compared to bioaccumulation by aquatic organisms. And finally, applications vary, but they can include looking at water column and interstitial water concentrations over the duration of a remediation at a Superfund site, looking at sources of contamination from within a contaminated site to better understand the dynamics of the contamination, possibly for developing the site model. And finally, just an overall summary statement, and that is that passive sampling is something that is being adopted very readily in the environmental sciences and is probably going to become a very, very common sampling technique in the future. And so by that, I mean, I don't think it's just a passing, fad that's going to go away in a few years. I think it's going to be here for a very long time. So I think it's worthwhile for the agency to adopt the use of passive sampling at Superfund sites. So I will stop there and thank you for your attention and apologize that my computer chose to stop working two-thirds of the way through. All right, thank you.
Well, thank you so very much. We appreciate that. We do have a number of questions that have already been submitted electronically. For those of you that are still participating online or listening in on the phones, if you haven't yet typed up your question or comment or you're in the middle of doing that, go ahead. We're going to take a brief break here and I'll start reading through some questions. To submit your comment or question for Dr. Burgess, you're going to type in the lower right corner of your screen where there's a few messages from me, Jean Ballant. You're going to click on that white box on the very bottom and start typing in your question or comment. So Dr. Burgess, if you're ready, let's begin. Our first question came early in your talk, and this participant would like to know how the detection limits were established.
I guess when I'm talking about them, I'm talking in a fairly generic way, just to say that in terms of the solubilities of the types of compounds that we try to measure with or try to detect with passive samplers, again, these very hydrophobic organic contaminants, if you're just taking 5 liters of water or 6 liters of water, there just isn't going to be very much contaminant present. So analytically, detecting those contaminants will be very difficult. In contrast, as I tried to show, that with the passive samplers over time, they are actually accumulating the contaminants. And as a result, detection limits, again, in a very sort of generic way, aren't as much of an issue. You don't have as much difficulty detecting the contaminants because you have now basically taken maybe we don't need to go into this in too much detail, but during the deployment period, it's possible that the passive sampler is intercepting hundreds of liters of water. And so some of the contaminants associated with that hundreds of liters of water are partitioning into the passive sampler. So rather than just sampling from that 5 liters or 6 liters of water that we might do using conventional methods, with the passive sampler, we're sampling many, many tens or hundreds of liters. And so consequently, there's just a lot more contaminants present to detect when you do your extraction and then run it on your GC mass spec or your GC-ECD.
Okay, great. Our next participant would like to know if you could comment on the potential for fouling communities that are growing on the passive samplers.
Yeah, that's a very good question. And that's where the PRCs come in handy. Because in principle, if you have some sort of growth that occurs on your sampler, and this will happen in many systems, especially during the summer when you just have a lot of biological activity, if you have PRCs in the sampler, as your target contaminants are trying to get into the passive sampler and having to make their way through any growth that may have occurred, the PRCs are having the same issue trying to go from the polymer out into the aquatic environment. And so the PRCs capture the effects of the growth hindering transport of the target contaminants as well as the PRCs. So that's, and I didn't mention that explicitly during the talk, but that's where PRCs, along with providing directly equilibrium information, they also help to take into account the effects of growth on the samplers.
Okay, great. We do have a few participants with questions about FPMDs. That's an acronym that they're using. The first participant wants to know, why are the FPMDs not typically used for sediments? And then the second participant, I think we kind of answered it by stating that one, is they want to know why they're not discussed in this presentation or in the guidance document.
So as the first question asked, they don't get used in sediments very often. One reason is just physically they can break open, and as I showed you in that cartoon, the SPMDs are polyethylene tubing that is surrounded by, it's a polyethylene tubing, and it's filled with that synthetic lipid, triolein. And so you can run into issues with deploying these things in sediment, having them rip open, and you're not sure when that has happened, and so during the deployment. So you probably will lose the lipid material. You'll end up with an empty or damaged SPMD, and it really just complicates their use in sediments when, by contrast, you can just take a sheet of PE or SPME fiber or sheet of POM and put it into the sediments, and you don't have to worry about the loss of any of the any sort of lipid material. The other thing about SPMDs, just really a logistical issue, is that the extraction of the contaminants from the triolein is a little bit more complicated than simply extracting the POM or the PE or the SPME fibers. So they are a little bit more complicated to use. Now, I should say with SPMDs, there's a great deal of data on them. There was a lot of work done with them in the late 80s and in the 90s, and there still is work done. But the focus of the SAMS document was passive samplers that could be used relatively easily with both water column deployments and sediment deployments. And so that's why the SPMDs kind of fell out of that discussion.
Okay. Okay, we have a couple of participants with questions regarding slide number 18. With some of the variables you were doing, or with the equations that were on there. So okay. Bear with me while I'm going to click back to try to pull that slide up for everybody. And the first question regarding slide number 18 wants to know, what exactly does the D in equation on slide number 18 stand for?
Oh, okay. Yeah, they just dissolved. Okay. D stands for dissolved.
And then we had another participant come right in with a question about C. What is the negative C? So I'm not sure if I'm reading the question properly.
Yeah, the intent, that's not a negative. It's just supposed to be a dash. Sometimes I find with PowerPoint it's hard to make the equations exactly the way you want them to look. So that's just a dash. So it's the K is partition coefficient, and then more specifically it's the sampler dissolved coefficient. So that dash is not meant to be a negative sign.
Okay. We do have a couple of questions just talking about equilibrium. We have one participant who wants to know that they understand how equilibrium can be obtained in the water spaces, but could you please explain how this can be obtained in an open water column scenario where there are current flows?
I don't know if I fully understand the question. In principle, under those conditions, with sufficient time, and if there's a lot of flow, the contaminants will accumulate between the passive sampler and the aqueous environment where the passive samplers are deployed. I mean, and this is maybe another case where the PRCs come in. One interpretation of the PRC approach to equilibrium is that you load up your passive sampler with PRCs, put them into the environment, and if when you analyze, after you've recovered the passive sampler, and you find all the PRCs are gone, that would indicate to you...
Are you still with us? See, Dr. Burgess, if you're still on the phone, please feel free to speak up and let me know that you're there. Sounds like we may have had a problem with this phone line. So we're just going to go ahead and wait just a few seconds to see if Dr. Burgess is calling back in. Dr. Burgess, please remember to unmute your phone using the #6 command and just confirm that you're with us on the telephone lines. And we'll wait just a moment. If we don't have him join us back on the line, we may launch right into the next presentation and then use the remaining time that we have. We can get him back on the phone lines to address the questions. We do have a number of questions still in the queue for Dr. Burgess, so we'll wait just a few more seconds to see if we can get him back on the phone lines. And if we cannot, I think if Dr. Greenberg, are you on the phone?
Yeah, Jean, I'm here.
Okay, great.
And Jean,
so,
I'm back.
You're there. Okay, great.
How is that as a way to evade a question? So I think, as I was saying, the interpretation of the PRC data in that case is if all the PRCs appear to be have left the passive sampler, you know, after you do the deployment, take them, the passive samplers, into the laboratory and analyze them. The interpretation, if all the PRCs are gone, you cannot detect them in the passive sampler, is that the PRC has achieved equilibrium during its deployment, and the target contaminants that those PRCs are supposed to be matched up with would also have reached equilibrium. So again, I guess I keep going back to the PRCs and the value of them for determining when equilibrium has been achieved.
Okay, and we just also had a participant, I think you may have just answered the question, but I'm going to read this one out loud. One of our guests asked, with PRCs, is the hope to determine the time point of reaching equilibrium, the performance of the sampler, and in parentheses, comparing between the materials or to organisms, or is it both? Are there any differences with exposure media, water versus sediment, pore water with the PRCs?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of questions in there. With the water column, with PRCs in water column deployments, generally you find, in with the target compounds also, you find you achieve equilibrium more rapidly because there's just a better, easier flow of contaminants between the passive sampler and the aqueous environment because there aren't obstructions. When you get into the sediments and get into the sediment interstitial waters, you actually have physical obstructions, which are the particles that interfere with the ability of the contaminants to move around as easily as they can up in the water column. Now, on the other hand, because you're in the sediments and the type of contaminants we're talking about accumulate in sediments because of the presence of organic carbon and black carbon, you tend to have more contaminants in the sediments. But what we have found anyway, and I think others working with PRCs have found, is that in the water column, you tend to see the PRCs reach equilibrium faster than in the sediments. So I don't know if that answered part of the person's question.
No, I think you've done a great job on that one. We still have a number of questions that are in the queue, so I'm going to try to get through as many as I can over the next 6 minutes or so, and then we'll move on to our next speaker, and then, of course, still take more time at the end of today's talk for some additional questions. So our very next question gets into differences in terms of the materials. And this participant asks, with all of these different details regarding materials and deployment, what are the comparability issues, or is there really any comparability at all between the various studies that you've shown?
You know, I think that's an area where the literature is still developing. We have done, as I mentioned in one of the slides, one of our goals, and part of that was for preparing the SAMS document, was to, whenever possible, compare as many different passive samplers simultaneously as possible. So maybe not so much to figure out how they compare in terms of partition coefficients and things like that, but more logistical issues. Are there passive samplers that just aren't very easy to work with, that fail for various reasons? And in general, that sort of comparison, sort of an operational comparison, we have tended to find the PE and the POM behave very similarly, and that makes sense because they're both polymer sheets, whereas the SPME, because of its being on a fiber, sort of a fiber matrix, is just a little bit different to work with. But as I mentioned during the advantages and disadvantages slide, the SPEMIs equilibrate very quickly compared to the other two, compared to the PE and the POM. So on an operational basis, I would say the PE and the POM are fairly similar, and SPEMIs a bit different. As I started to say at the beginning of answering this question, I don't think we have all the data yet to do a thorough comparison of the different types of passive samplers based on, say, as I started to say, partition coefficients and that sort of information. I think that's something we're just going to have to wait for the literature to provide for us over the next year or two. And given there's so much work going on with passive samplers, I think those sorts of comparisons will start to come out fairly soon.
Okay. We have another participant that wants to know, are there any usability or validation guidance in the works for these samplers and analytical methods?
Yeah, that's a good question, too. I think with the CTAC document, the CTAC papers coming out in the scientific literature, they'll have some of that kind of information. And the CERTUP ESTCP documentation document that's coming out in a year or two, because the plan for that document is to actually have SOPs, they will have that kind of very specific performance information that I think a lot of people will be interested in having access to.
Okay. We have a participant that wants to know how you determine the K values. We have other questions coming in regarding the ranges for KD.
Sure. The partition coefficients, there's an empirical way, you know, an actual laboratory-based way where you take a large volume of water, and depending on what kind of system you're working with, fresh water or salt water, you inoculate that with the contaminants of concern that you're interested in, say PCB congeners, and then you introduce into that system very small pieces of passive sampler, PE, POM, SPEMI. And you can design this experiment different ways, but one simplistic way to do it is to take that very large volume of water, as I said, inoculate it with contaminants, add some passive samplers to it, very, very small passive samplers, because you don't want to deplete the system. And then over time, just pull out individual pieces of the passive sampler, analyze them, and you should develop from that an uptake curve. And at some point in that uptake curve, you'll establish an equilibrium where the concentration in the passive sampler is not changing, and ideally the concentration in the liquid phase is not changing. And you take divide those two numbers by each other, the concentration in the sampler divided by the concentration in the water, and that's a sort of gives you a simple partition coefficient. And there have been several studies where people have done that with SPEMI, with POM, with PE. Now, another way to do that, to develop a partition coefficient, say for a compound that you're interested in, is more of a modeling approach, and that is to generate a correlation relationship between KOW in the partition coefficients that are available in the literature for a whole bunch of different contaminants. And so you come up with a linear equation that describes that relationship between the passive sampler partition coefficient and the KOW for a given set of compounds. Use that linear equation and just plug in the KOW of the compound you're interested in, for which there isn't a empirical partition coefficient available, and you can calculate using that equation the partition coefficient. And so the passive sampler partition coefficient for that contaminant. And there have been several studies that have used that approach for coming up with partition coefficients where there weren't empirical ones available.
Okay. Well, we do have, several more questions still in the queue. But I think in the interest of time, what we're going to go ahead and do is take a break here from the questions directed for Dr. Burgess, and we're going to segue over to the next portion of our discussion, which will actually be presented by our next speaker, Dr. Mark Greenberg. We'll also take some time for questions, and then we'll come back to some of the outstanding questions that we have. I think, Mark, you might be able to address some of them. We have some participants that wanted to know about long-term considerations if you deploy them in the field for longer than 6 months, et cetera. So we'll go through your presentation, and then we still have a lot of time available to continue going through as many questions as we can in the time allotted. So I want to thank Dr. Burgess for his time and ask him if he can hang on the line through the end of today's talk. We'll come back to you with some more questions at the end.
Sure.
Let me go ahead and introduce our next speaker. Our next presentation is going to be delivered by Dr. Mark Greenberg, who's an environmental scientist and toxicologist here at the EPA's Environmental Response Team, where he supports cleanup, emergency, and other response actions within the Superfund program. His primary area of focus is the assessment, remediation, and management of contaminated assessment sites. Dr. Greenberg provides technical and policy advice in the fields of contaminated sediments, toxicology, ecological risk assessment, oil spill response, and groundwater to surface water interactions. He has basically worked in the development and post-remedial as well as baseline monitoring programs, sediment sampling programs, emergency response plans, performance standards, habitat assessments, and remedial investigations. Dr. Greenberg obtained a BA in zoology and an MS in aquatic toxicology from Miami University, and a PhD in biomedical science.
The history and the concepts and a lot of the theory behind the use of passive samplers. I'm going to start by just providing a little bit of background for where we're coming from for the second half of our seminar today. Essentially, when we're talking about the management of contaminated sediments, what we're talking about is including control of sources, as well as the use of institutional controls, applying remediation technologies or remediation approaches, and then evaluating the effectiveness of those selected management actions. Contaminant analyses for bulk or whole sediments often serve as the critical line of evidence, or as one of the critical lines of evidence that are used to support the decision making to take an action and perform remediation at sites. So this is a lot of the information that's built into the remedial investigation and feasibility studies. However, we've found over the years that the use of bulk and whole sediment concentrations are relatively poor predictors of exposure and subsequent risk, since contaminant bioavailability is often ignored. One way to get around this was the development of equilibrium partitioning models that were developed to predict freely dissolved concentrations in sediment pore water, but these also have some limitations. For example, they don't often reliably characterize bioavailability of contaminants in field sediments due to the presence of highly sorptive binding phases like soot or black carbon, and they don't account for sequestration processes. So driven partly by the high costs of remedial decisions and remediation and the scientific challenges with understanding risks at contaminated sites, it's led to the advances in the use of passive sampling methods with the primary goal of quantifying bioavailability of contaminants and sediments better than the tools that we have at hand historically. The second slide is a summary of some of the material that Rob's already gone over, and I'd just like you to focus on the yellow portion of the slide. These are the materials and the types of passive sampling phases that are available, as Rob's already summarized, for hazardous organic contaminants, or these HOCs. The take-home point that I'd like you to take, though, is that there are a number of different configurations that are available for all of these passive sampling techniques, whether they're coated fibers or vials, films and sheets, and the like, such as Rob has shown, that you as the operator or the project manager have some control in selecting. So there are various approaches and configurations that you can choose from. The next slide shows how we can estimate what I'm calling C-free throughout the rest of my slides. And C-free is analogous to the terms that Rob was using before, the freely dissolved and bioavailable concentration, or the CD term in his equations. So I'll be using C-free. And essentially, just to review some of the materials that Rob's gone over in great detail, at equilibrium, the chemical activity of a target hydrophobic organic contaminant in sediment, biological and passive sampling phases is assumed to be equal. And the freely dissolved concentration, or the C-free, can be estimated from the HOC concentration that's associated with the passive sampler itself, or the CP term. So the approach involves measuring the equilibrated polymer concentration and then subsequent translation to the C-free term by using the substance-specific polymer water partition coefficient, or KPW. And as some of the questions have been leading to, it's very important that we have accurate KPWs to draw from so that we can better estimate what this bioavailable C-free term is. So one of the questions that we're often asked is, what's the regulatory acceptance of these newer methods, these passive sampling methods? And generally, they're accepted. They're already being used at several sites. The most common use that we've seen so far is in revisions to the conceptual site model. But there's no formal Superfund acceptance process. Essentially, this is like any other technical tool that project managers have to their avail in conducting and completing their remedial investigations and feasibility studies. And if passive samplers can help the remedial project managers, the RPMs, answer key site questions, they can then be used. For example, is there a risk? What are the key exposure pathways? What are the risk-based goals and sediment cleanup levels? How can I best determine what the remedy effectiveness was? And similar types of questions. So another problem that's been brought to us by a number of folks in the scientific community is, well, then why aren't passive sampling methods used more widely? Some of the key barriers that we see to further acceptance include that there's, to date, we haven't done a very good job of allowing practitioners and decision makers to understand the advantages and limitations of these chemical-based approaches over traditional analytical methods. Part of our point today is to help us overcome some of those deficiencies in our explanations historically and start to bring the information forward a bit more clearly and concisely to everyone. There's also been confusion regarding the myriad of different methods and formats that are increasingly reported in the literature. The methods that Rob and I have summarized in these two presentations are the ones that seem to be most commonly useful. So that's kind of a take-home point for you. And then for the larger scientific community, there's been a lack of consensus on technical guidance for passive sampling methods in terms of their selection and standardized methods, and also how best to apply them in regulatory decision-making contexts. It's also been noted that there's limited experience in the use and analysis of passive sampling methods by commercial laboratories, and there's still some uncertainty in terms of their cost versus their benefit, and especially their comparative costs relative to standard methods that are available. So because of these issues, and as Rob has already mentioned, there was a Pelston workshop that was hosted by CTEC, the Society of Environmental Toxicology and Chemistry. And on this slide, I've shown the title of a summary document that cites additional materials. I'll work with Gene on seeing if we can make that happen. And I've also listed here all the participants that were present at that workshop. It includes Robert Burgess and myself, representing EPA. So a number of the slides that follow here are taken from some of the overall take-homes from that workshop, and those are kind of interspersed through the rest of my talk here. We spent a lot of time evaluating the state of the science of passive samplers, and it was generally accepted at the workshop that C3 provides a more relevant exposure metric than total or bulk sediment concentrations. And most of the work has been done in hydrophobic organic contaminants. And overall, we felt that, and I think at EPA, we also feel that these passive samplers are more ready for prime time with regard to organic contaminants. There's still some work to be done with metals, but there have also been some advances made with metals. But there's a significant literature that's already available that details the calibration and application of passive sampling methods in sediment assessments for organic contaminants. And there's also estimates, and we've also seen that estimates of C3 from passive sampling methods have been shown to be a better predictor of measurement endpoints of interest, such as sediment bioaccumulation, which is shown in this figure down here, where we have predicted tissue concentrations from the C3 measurement multiplied by the KOW of the PCBs or PAHs that are shown in this figure here, regressed against the tissue concentrations that were measured in organisms that were exposed to sediments. And as you can see, we've got a very nice relationship here using that C3 term to predict what the tissue concentration will be. Similarly, with some toxicity data, this is a commonly used figure to show the benefits of using pore water concentrations as the dose metric for response curves or for response data. And compared to showing this exact same survival data against bulk sediment concentrations, we had no relationship. But if you use the pore water concentrations, we show that we have a very nice relationship discerned from these data. So we found an improvement to our ability to evaluate the toxicity data with the use of pore water data. Some other examples include some work that we've done in collaboration with others. This was a CERTA-funded project that was conducted in part by ERT. Researchers from the University of Texas, the Army Corps of Engineers, and the University of Michigan, and also the Navy System Center Pacific, the SPAWAR Center. And what we did there was we exposed in situ some mussels, Muscalista species, to some contaminated sediments at the Naval Station in San Diego. And we also had co-located measurements of the sediments using SPEMIs that were equipped, as Rob has described, by Danny Rival's group using these push-point samplers. And we also took the bulk concentrations, and we also did some centrifugation work. So we were just trying to look at what correlates best with tissue concentrations accumulated by these mussels. So this first graph down here shows the regression for bulk concentration. These are TOC normalized, total organic carbon normalized concentrations of PAHs against the tissue concentrations measured in the exposed mussels, and we have a relatively poor regression. When we used the pore water concentrations that were estimated using the SPEMIs, we found that the regression improved greatly. And when we used the centrifuge samples that were, the sediments were taken back to the lab and centrifuged, and the pore water concentrations from that centrifugation were measured, we found that we had a slight improvement of the regression versus using bulk sediment concentrations, but still the estimates of pore water concentrations using the passive samplers gave us the strongest relationships. So back to some of the points from the workshop, we discussed applications of these passive samplers in laboratory and field settings. Again, the consensus during all these application discussions was that the PSMs are generally ready for application. And through discussion, we came up with five key guiding principles for the selection, preparation, implementation, and validation of the passive sampling methods. So the first step shown here in this box is to define the questions that are being posed by the project managers that need to be addressed using some measurement of C3 with passive samplers. These can be questions related to the various endpoints that we typically encounter in sediment assessments, which could include sediment toxicity, bioaccumulation, transport, i.e. flux and chemical gradients, either within the sediments or spatially across the site, so that would be the spatial extent of delineation. Whether you're trying to develop a site-specific carbon organic carbon partition coefficient, and also whether you're trying to get pore water terms that can help with model calibration or verification of predictions. So the second guiding principle was to ask and determine what the pros and cons are of doing an ex situ or a laboratory study, bringing samples back into the laboratory, versus an in situ or a field application of the passive samplers. So this would include considerations of site accessibility and security of equipment if you were to leave it on site, what the time and the costs are of doing a laboratory study versus the field, the level of expertise that's required to conduct the study. We typically find that we have more laboratory-trained personnel at our avail quickly than we do field-trained personnel, so that's something that needs to be considered. Also, regulatory endemic species, and we've been involved in other situations where some folks did not want any introduced species or the potential for introduced species entering the environment. So, you know, we've had regulatory pressures on either side of the in situ question posed to us. Also, the importance of spatial resolution should play into whether you do a field study or a laboratory study, and also temporal resolution. I apologize, something happened to this slide. And then third, you want to perform a trade-off analysis of key considerations to help select what the most appropriate passive sampling method is for your problem. Technical considerations will include what your target analytes of interest are, physical chemical conditions like temperature and salinity and how they may affect the behavior and the ability of the passive samplers to sample the material or the contaminant of interest, what your time for deployment is, various performance specifications, the known sensitivity, accuracy, and precision of a given method, and also what its commercial availability is. And then fourth, one also needs to establish QA/QC guidelines for the project. And a lot of what Rob was talking about with regard to the use of performance reference compounds, or PRCs, would come into play here. So many of the applications that we see these passive sampling methods used for include nature and extent studies, flux measurements, some evaluation of remedial options, especially as they pertain to changes in pore water concentration or concentrations of contaminants in the biologically active zone of sediments, exposure and risk assessment, part of the remedial investigation, and also they might be used in ladder tiers of a tiered assessment approach. But essentially, the last step is to quantify the uncertainty associated with your passive sampler measurements and propagate it through the risk analysis or other aspects of the remedial investigation and feasibility studies. And what the consensus is at this time is that the uncertainty associated with C-free measurements using passive sampling methods is expected to be only a fraction of the uncertainty associated with what we're currently doing, with the status quo. Partitioning processes for sediment-associated contaminants, which operate over small spatial scales, can vary as geochemical properties of the sediments. Changes over scales on the order of tens to thousands of meters, then one could expect that contaminant bioavailability at the site is likely going to change as a result as well. So having passive sampler data can provide some insights into the role of some of these exposure-modifying processes that operate at multiple spatial and temporal scales at our contaminated sites, but we don't have the ability to go out and sample at each one of those scales, you know, specifically for a specific question on those individual scales. So conceptual site models that incorporate pathways for which C3 is a relevant metric may need to integrate small-scale exposure features with larger-scale processes to provide proper context for assessment and management. So what I mean here is features such as what the hydrodynamic processes are, redistribution of contaminants and resuspension, dilution of contaminants, burial of contaminated sediments with cleaner material that might be entering the site, the bed load movement of sediment particles, this also includes resuspension, and fluid mud. All this needs to be conceptualized to better target the kinds of measurements one might make with passive samplers. And really what it does is it gets to improving our characterization of exposure under current and future conditions expected within the system. We can get closer to what the exposure point concentrations and doses organisms will be experiencing are, and move away from just understanding or just measuring contaminant mass distribution. And these further refined analyses can help project the effects of remedial actions. So in terms of supporting modeling, passive sampling methods and passive sampling devices can be a source of input parameters for models. These could include contaminant mass balance models, sediment and contaminant transport, exposure and dose responses, bioaccumulation modeling, engineering design. We've seen that pore water is often a critical engineering design term that's necessary in cap design. And rather than estimating these with equilibrium partitioning approaches, we're finding that passive sampling can help refine some of those estimates. And also some of these measurements of C-free can be helpful in forecasting risk reductions and site recovery projections in any future forecast models. So what these passive sampling-based C-free measurements can give to site managers is a better predictor of bioavailability for three key exposure pathways. Direct exposure to invertebrates, these are specific to toxicology and bioaccumulation types of questions in risk assessments. They can assist with understanding flux from sediments to the overlying water column, which will then provide better information to identify what exposures in the water column are currently or would be expected to be under future conditions. So again, these measurements of C-free with passive sampling methods can reduce uncertainty in risk assessments and the subsequent management decisions that are typically based on solid phase data, bulk concentrations. We want to move away from that and move into using the more relevant bioavailable concentrations for these decisions. So where do we see this going in terms of applying more widely passive sampling methods in the context of sediment management? Well, we've covered a number of examples and types of use in site investigations and risk assessment. And again, these are the kinds of studies that form the technical basis of cleanup decisions. Pore water concentration estimates, such as the uses that were discussed on the previous slides, is one way. Moving toward the use of passive sampling measurements as a dose metric, like the PAH example I showed on an earlier slide that had the PAHs, the PAH-34 pore water concentrations versus the high level survival. And also, C-free can be an indicator of bioaccumulation and or bioavailability. In terms of increased use in remedial effectiveness monitoring, surface and pore water concentration estimates using passive samplers can help us identify bioavailability trends and changes over time. They can be used in sediment cap and amendment performance studies. They can serve, and Rob covered some of this in his talk, as surrogates for benthic organism bioaccumulation. As Rob covered, there's been some research done on this over the last 6 or 7 years. And things might be looking good in terms of passive sampling devices being used as actual surrogates for benthic organisms. However, for fish, the current thoughts are that passive samplers are good indicators, but because they're not truly biomimetic devices, they may not be good surrogates for fish. And just a little bit more detail on this. Monitoring with PSMs could reflect changes in overlying water concentrations of contaminants that ultimately affect uptake into aquatic organisms. So combining the evidence of passive samplers in the surface that are applied in the surface and pore waters, the latter of which, the pore water C-free concentrations, would be an indicator of bioaccumulation by sediment-associated biota that are potentially the prey items of given fish, You know, combining this information can be used to determine when fish tissue evaluations would be appropriate for assessing whether fish consumption advisories should be set, make a good time to collect fish tissue information. And regarding remedial effectiveness monitoring for CAPS, here's just an example for some uses in CAP monitoring. This illustrates depth-integrated sampling using SPEMI fibers, again using a modified Henry pushpoint sampler. And this data is from Danny Reibel again. And what you can see is that PAH pore water concentration data in various depths within the CAP can be measured and that the concentration profile can be observed. So generally we see lower concentrations in the upper portions of the CAP. So zero right here would be the CAP water interface, CAP surface water interface, and then we've got various depths and inches into the CAP. Generally, so there's lower concentrations in the surface of the CAP, and as we go down into the CAP and into the contaminated sediments, we see that concentrations are higher. So this technique can be used to ensure that the CAPs are operating as we think they are. We can use them for CAP compliance measurements. For example, in the biologically active zone, if we consider maybe the top 6 to 12 inches being the biologically active zone, there could be a compliance point that's routinely monitored within this area to be a good evaluator of CAP effectiveness. We can also, I'm going to skip this slide and just move on to slide 21. We can also use these kinds of measurements for year-to-year comparisons. So here we've got pore water concentrations from within a CAP. These are again for PAHs, measured in 2009 and in 2010. And what we're looking for are relative differences here. This dark black line is the one-to-one line. And you can see that when you do a regression of the 2009 to 2010 data, they fall pretty nicely on the one-to-one line, indicating that there's relatively stable concentrations of the PAHs within the CAP at this location. However, at a different location, taking the same kinds of measurements in the CAP, 2009 again to 2010, here's the one-to-one line here shown in dark red, and we can see that from the regression, from the data, the 2010 data appear to be higher than the 2009 data, and what this is indicating is it's not necessarily an alarm, but it does allow for calculation of transport rates through the CAP and what potential break time, breakthrough times would be. So these are just examples of potential uses of these kinds of data. So this is my last slide, and it's basically to try and summarize potential assessment and risk management applications using passive samplers. What we're seeing is that we're going to be getting improvements from using these approaches in our C3, our bioavailable concentration determinations, and in data collection for observing bioavailability. And this will increase certainty in our risk assessments. Applications are wide-ranging and can include ambient or compliance monitoring programs, quantifying spatial and temporal trends in bioavailable contaminants, identifying contaminant sources. We're moving toward using C3 measurements as dose metrics to better develop dose response or concentration response relationships. Understanding risk zones based on the likelihood of effects. So sampling an area and understanding what the pore water concentrations of bioavailable contaminants are throughout the site to better target potential remedial areas. These data can be used as input parameters or for verification of models. There's short and long-term monitoring of chemical bioavailability that can be done both before, during, and after remediation. We can evaluate the results of sediment treatment, disposal, or beneficial reuse following management actions. And as I've shown just a couple examples with regard to CAPS, these can be used for evaluating remedy effectiveness. So with that, I'd like to thank you on behalf of myself and Rob for your attention today.
Okay, so let's go ahead and take advantage of the time we have left and start going through those questions. Remember, you can continue to type up your comments and questions for either Dr. Burgess or Dr. Greenberg by entering them into the Q&A window in the lower right corner of the screen. Mark, I'm going to start with some questions that came in during your portion of the talk, and we'll see if you can answer them, and if you think Dr. Burgess would have a better complimentary response, feel free to interact with him. So the first question wants to know if passive samplers would be an appropriate surrogate for benthic organisms that are sediment ingestors. Mark, are you still with me?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Okay.
Rob, why don't you take that one?
Can you hear me?
Yes, you can.
Okay, great. Yeah, that's a good question. This always comes up in terms of thinking about equilibrium sampling and equilibrium partitioning. And what I would say is if you go back to the slide I showed, number 40.
Okay, we'll have slide number 40 up in just one moment. Okay, feel free.
Okay, right there. Thank you. So what this plot is showing on the y-axis, we have bioaccumulation in a worm, a benthic worm, and then on the x-axis, we have the concentration accumulated in the PE. So we're not showing dissolved phase concentration in this case. This is actual accumulation by the PE versus bioaccumulation by the worm. Now, we know this species of polychaete is exposed via the interstitial water, some contact with the sediment, but also ingesting the sediment while it's, you know, moving around its sediment habitat. And with the passive sampler, in principle, it is being exposed to the contaminants in the interstitial water, maybe a little bit through physical contact with the particles and the contaminants transferring from the particle surface over into the passive sampler, but primarily through the interstitial water. And what we see here is a very strong one-to-one relationship. So even though the passive sampler is not obviously ingesting the sediment, but the worm is, we get very good agreement in terms of bioaccumulation versus accumulation. So to answer the question, I think this is just one example of data that would suggest that the passive sampler can serve as an effective surrogate for a benthic organism. And let me just tell you the design of this study real quick. In this study, we had sediments from a Superfund site that high levels of PCBs. The worms were put into the system, and so were the passive samplers. So the worms and the passive samplers were in the same contaminated sediment throughout the exposure. The exposures were 28 days to 30 days long, I believe. And
this is the one that I brought up earlier with a participant that wants to know about issues regarding long-term deployment. They'd like specifically want a discussion on any issues, if there are any. And, you know, for example, if you leave something in the water for more than 6 months in a marine environment, what do they need to be aware of or consider in that situation?
Yeah, I think I heard that question before I gave the talk. And I've not seen deployments longer than about 60 days or so in the work that I've done. And a lot of it, in terms of your deployment time, is really based on the design specifications of the passive sampler and what the estimated times for it to reach equilibrium would be in given environmental situations or under certain dynamic environmental conditions. What we've found is typically that 21 days is adequate for representing what we're seeing in organisms, similar to that example that I showed with marine mussels. But in freshwater systems using midges and using oligochaetes, we've also seen that 21 days seems to be a good deployment time for passive samplers. So what I would encourage is, rather than setting up monitoring programs where you're leaving things out for, 6 months or longer, we look for more opportunities to use passive samplers in, more time-efficient sampling protocols, because the data seem to be giving us what we want in those shorter time frames.
Okay. We have a couple of individuals have actually asked if there are any passive samplers that have been developed for methylmercury, or if it's even applicable to that contaminant at all.
I've seen some DGTs, which are diffusion through thin gradient samplers, which again are metals, which wasn't much of the focus of what Rob and I are talking about today. But there have been some of these DGTs that have been designed for application in mercury sites for both elemental and methylmercury. But those samplers are still undergoing quite a bit of research and refinement. So again, I wouldn't look at those as being ready for a prime time application. But, sometimes they provide decent information and other times they provide equivocal information. So really, for some of the braver project managers out there, those are at that stage of development at this time.
And I would just add to that, with the type of samplers that Mark was just talking about with metals, they're not truly equilibrium samplers. They don't give you a dissolved concentration or dissolved and bioavailable concentration of the metal. They give you more of a sense of the gradient in concentration of the metal in the given system you're sampling. So you're getting a different kind of information than with those types of samplers than you get with the passive samplers that we've been talking about today.
Okay. We have another question that comes in, let me just go back. There was a clarifying statement to the person who was asking about long-term deployment. They just wanted to add a comment that they have a location that they're sampling that's very inaccessible, so they can't go to pick up their samples very frequently, and that's really where their background was coming from. So I don't know if you have any thoughts or comments. If you have an inaccessible location, what one would do?
This is Rob. We have done some deployments off of Costa California for about 4 months. And, I think what you run into is more logistics type issues, and it seems like the person asking the question is concerned about logistics. And, if you're using a POM or a PE sampler, just the probability that over, the longer the sampler is out there, the more likely it's going to get damaged, it'll fall apart, it'll be eroded away just by the conditions increase. So I think that's really the concern, is just damage and loss of the sampler when you deploy for that long. In principle, if you have some polymer left by the time you go out again, you should be able to analyze it and make an estimate of the concentration of the contaminants associated with the sampler, as well as an estimate of the dissolved phase concentration, a time-integrated estimate of the dissolved concentration.
Okay. We actually have two participants that have questions about commercial availability. One participant states that you mentioned commercial availability as a technical consideration, and they want to know if you've actually encountered many off-the-shelf products. And sort of along those same lines, we have participants who are looking for examples in commercial laboratories that can actually analyze the samplers.
This is Rob. I know that the Test America, taking the last question first, Test America is a commercial testing laboratory. I know they do analyze SPINI under some circumstances, so that's one commercial laboratory. I did a little search before our presentations today to see if a few of the commercial labs were advertising that they analyze passive samplers, and unfortunately I didn't see a lot of them doing that. Some of the more research consultant type laboratories like Battelle and labs like that will analyze passive samplers in a given project, but not really in a commercial mode. In terms of availability of the passive samplers, as I showed in the photographs early on, the PE you can purchase from hardware stores, POM you can purchase from the manufacturer. So it's easily, and SPEMI as well, the fibers you can purchase from a couple of companies, at least a couple of companies. So getting the material is relatively easy. Getting it prepared for deployment, that's still an area that we really need the commercial laboratories to get more engaged with at this point. I think the research laboratories would do that type of work for you, but I don't think the commercial CLP laboratories would be doing that at this point.
Okay.
Yeah, that's pretty much right. I'll just add to what Rob has said. And one of the reasons that I provided the slide on all the participants from the CTAC workshop was to just allow people to see who out there is doing this kind of work. And as Rob has said, a lot of the researchers are folks that you can contact for more specific information on their capabilities or at least their knowledge of where you can achieve these services. So I would recommend that you look to some of the academics that are on that list to get more specific information in terms of laboratory capabilities, contract laboratories that are doing this kind of work, and where supplies are available.
That's okay. A good point.
Okay, great. We have a question that came in earlier, but we have a participant who's really looking for more clarification. They ask, why is there a low R-squared value for sediment to tissue and a high correlation between tissue and PSM and sediment?
Is that a question on one of my slides?
I believe this one is actually going back to Dr. Burgess. And again, the question is, why is there a low R-squared value for sediment to tissue and a high correlation between tissue and PSM in the sediment?
Rob, I'm thinking this is a question that hits right on the point of the sediment concentrations don't give you an indication of bioavailability.
Yeah.
Whereas
total.
It's the bioavailable fraction that you're better characterizing with a passive sampler relative to the tissue.
Yeah, I would agree. Unless you're expressing your sediment concentration in some way that emphasizes the bioavailable concentration of the contaminants, sometimes if you normalize your total sediment concentration by the organic carbon content, and you compare that to bioaccumulation by organisms, you can get a relatively good R-square. But like Mark's saying, if you're just looking at total concentration of contaminants on sediments on a dry weight basis, which is sort of our classic way of expressing contaminated sediment or soil data, you just get a very poor correlation with bioaccumulation by organisms because there's no factoring in there of what was bioavailable in that total measurement of the sediment or soil contaminants.
Okay. We have another question. This should be a quick one, just related to bioaccumulation. One participant would like to know, for the bioaccumulation studies, are the organisms purated before analysis?
In the studies that I've been involved in, we depurate for at least 6 to 12 hours. And that's following consultation with scientists from our ORD. We'll also use 24 hours. It depends on the species and what information we already have in terms of what the appropriate depuration time is. But the short answer is, in the studies that we've done out of ERT on bioaccumulation, yes, we depurate.
Yeah, it's same here. We depurate the organisms as well for 24 hours usually with the polychaetes.
Okay. We have a rather lengthy statement and question that came in, so I'm going to read this one out loud, and bear with me. If you need me to repeat it, I will. This participant goes on to say, if we view PSDs as good indicators of relative changes in exposure over time, and if we recognize the difficulty of using fish for monitoring trends or remedy effectiveness due to their migration patterns and uncertainty in their seasonal use, of a site, would not PSDs be more reliable than FISH for confirming the response of a site to remediation or MNR?
That statement is very much in line with what I was trying to get across in terms of using PSMs as indicators for FISH bioaccumulation. You know, you have control over where you place the passive sampler device relative to your site remediation. So you can very well characterize what the exposure conditions are at a specific point on your site, and if you apply the passive samplers in a spatial context, across your entire site. So it can give you an indication of what the exposure conditions are. I don't agree that it would be a verification of what the accumulation is, however. You would need to sample the fish at some point in time. But it can help you explain why you're not seeing changes in fish that you might be expecting given the exposure concentrations that you're characterizing with the passive samplers.
Okay. We have another part. Yes, go ahead.
Gina, if I could, this is Rob, if I could just interject one thing. And just in addition to what Mark said, and the reason with fish, especially water column fish, that disconnect develops between the passive samplers and the sediments and the fish up in the water column is that the passive samplers can't take into consideration trophic transfer of contaminants as a result of what the fish are eating in terms of you know, other fish or other organisms. And so that's why that disconnect occurs, not because there's anything fundamentally wrong with using the passive samplers for looking at bioavailability.
Okay, great. All right, let's take a few more questions here. We have another participant that would like to know if you could speak to the measurement of C-free with depth in sediment. Is this done by spacing the openings in the sampler?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the way in which we've been doing it in conjunction with Danny Rival is we use a modified Henry sampler, which is just a push point sampler. Rob showed a nice picture of it. You do, as the operator, have control on drilling holes at various intervals. Other ways of configuring the sampler would be to have sections of SPME at various locations within the Henry sampler that are then placed at a certain depth in the sediment. So there's a lot of different ways you can do it. You can integrate over centimeters or inches. You can get small portions. You can cut small portions off of the fiber for specific inch or centimeter depths within the sediment bed. You really have a lot of control over it. It's very similar in concept to taking a core out of the sediments and sectioning it to meet whatever your needs are.
Okay.
In addition to that, the slide I showed from Palos Verdes where we had some water column concentrations as well as interstitial water concentrations of DDT, the way we generated those measurements is we had the PE in these aluminum frames that were stuck vertically into the sediment for about 30 days. Those frames were then recovered, taken to the surface, cleaned off a bit, and then sliced horizontally at half-centimeter intervals for the pieces of the passive sampler that were in the sediment. And then those horizontal slices were analyzed individually and, you know, noted where they were in the sediment column, and that's how we generated the depth profile for the interstitial waters at that site.
Yeah, okay. And I think, you know, with the description I just gave on the SPME fiber and the Henry sampler and Rob's description, the investigator has a lot of flexibility in how they want to characterize the depth profiles.
Okay. Well, I think we are actually right at our scheduled end time of 4 p.m. We do have some other questions, but I just wanted to sort of draw everyone's attention to the fact that your contact information is actually available on the seminar homepage, and I'll work to share some of the other questions and comments with the organizers, but I believe you guys have both shared names of individuals from a number of organizations and locations who work in this area. So if people have additional questions or outstanding items that they'd like to talk with, is it okay if they go ahead and try to reach out to you or some of the names that have been shared in your presentation?
Yes. Yeah, no problem, Jean.
Yep. Okay, great. So let's go ahead and just try to have a couple of final thoughts, if either of you have them. First, Dr. Burgess, any closing thoughts or comments you'd like to share with the group?
I think just the way I finished up my portion of the presentation, that I think that use of passive sampling for environmental monitoring is here to stay. And so I would just encourage the folks in the Superfund program that they consider using passive sampler techniques. And I think once they start using passive sampling techniques or requesting commercial laboratories to use them, the commercial labs will start getting more up to speed on actually analyzing and preparing passive samplers for commercial use. So, yeah, the bottom line, I think, is just I think the agency wants to move into the direction of using passive samplers because they are scientifically very robust ways of collecting data, relatively inexpensive, and, just generate good information. And also, I just want to thank Mark for his portion of the presentation. And that's it.
Great, thanks. And Dr. Greenberg, any final thoughts from you?
Rob summarized things well. I think in the bigger picture, EPA and others in the scientific community are very interested in moving toward better characterization of bioavailability and focusing on the bioavailable contaminants to not only improve the or minimize the uncertainty in risk assessment, but also to improve decision-making and achievable remedies. So bioavailability underscored is kind of my take-home from all this kind of work in the sediment realm and work that's being done in the soils world as well.
Okay. Well, I do want to echo your thanks, and I just want to walk through a couple of important closeout reminders. We did have nearly 200 individuals join us from all over the world for today's broadcast. I want to thank everybody, as well as our organizers here from EPA and the other organizations who joined us. We hope that this is a valuable expenditure of your time and that we're going to see you or hear from you on a future CLUIN seminar. For those of you that joined us online and would like a copy of the slides, if you haven't done so already, you'll find links to some of the websites and the documents that were referenced throughout today's talks, as well as copies of the presentation materials to download from the seminar links or resource page. That's hyperlinked on the slide shown. It's also available to the right of your screen under related URLs. We also ask if you could take just a moment to fill out the short feedback form. I do read each and every one of the responses that comes in, and that's how we continue to offer and improve our online deliveries. If you share the line with multiple parties, each person can submit their own feedback form. Just fill out the form, and there will be a link that will appear to let someone else share their thoughts. If you don't have time to fill that form out now, don't worry. That hyperlink for the feedback is available from this point forward. So if you're one of the ones watching the recorded version of today's broadcast, that active hyperlink is still there, and you can even submit feedback based on the archived version of today's session. For anyone looking for CEUs or PDHs, we don't necessarily issue training certificates for our CLUIN seminars, but many of our participants are still able to earn credit. If you save the registration email, save copies of the agenda or description and then the presentation materials, and then fill out the feedback form, there's a box you can check, which is actually shown in the illustration here, that if you check that box, you can request a confirmation email to ensure that your email address is entered correctly on the feedback form to make sure that you get that confirmation message. So again, thank you to those of you who joined us for today's live broadcast. Thank you to both of our presenters and our organizers from EPA. We appreciate everybody joining us today. And you will automatically get an email from me within 1 to 2 weeks once the archive is available from today's session so that you can share it and replay it with anyone who will find it useful information. Thanks so much for joining us, and I hope you have a great rest of your day. This represents the formal conclusion for today's CLUIN seminar.